Senate Special Committee on the Oregon Health Plan. Today, we will have a public hearing on 3624, and 3624A modifies the medical assistance program. I have some panels, and I will call you up, and we're not so crowded today that I have to do who's on deck. So just so that you know, because usually we have so many of you signed up that we do have to do who's on deck. And the first panel is Bruce Bishop, Barney Spate, and Doug Barber.
Three B's?
The B, and, well, let's see. No,
B,
it doesn't
B,
work.
It's one B-S.
Bruce, Barney, and Barber. Now.
Madam Chair, when I was in high school, they used to refer to me by my initials, and I always took umbrage at that. But
well,
as I've grown older, it may fit.
They were pretty prophetic.
I think you waded right into that one.
With that, I will try to redeem myself in the next few minutes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have made available written testimony. I will, in the interest of time, I will attempt to summarize it quickly. You did hear from Representatives Westland and Bates about the extensive work that has gone into 3624, and that the bill primarily focuses on improving the delivery systems available to the OHP, and it's an important component of the OHP strategy for the 03-05 biennium. Let me make some preliminary comments about the prepaid managed health care policy in 3624. The bill strengthens the state's policy commitment to prepaid managed health care. Early in this legislative session, key stakeholders, which included consumer advocates, physicians, hospitals, health plans, and the executive branch, agreed that one of the key objectives for the OHP in this era of fiscal contraction was preservation of the OHP delivery structure and capacity. Prepaid managed health care has improved client access to a wide range of health care services, especially primary physical, dental, and mental health services. In addition, the systems of care that have been developed over the years have improved the management of scarce resources and the quality of care provided to OHP eligibles. I would like to offer a word of caution. I do support the changes that have been made in the prepaid managed care policy statements, primarily in Section 2, but preservation of the OHP delivery structure and capacity is not guaranteed solely with the adoption of 3624. While it is an important framework for assuring the continuation and growth of prepaid managed care, the ultimate funding decisions made by the Legislative Assembly will control the destiny of prepaid managed health care. Fully capitated health plans and other managed care entities are able to organize systems of care only to the extent that the financial resources provided through their relationships with the state are adequate, to use a term that I've used for the last 6 months occasionally, to be able to make a market, that is, to be able to have signed contracts with local providers. The policy mandate to use prepaid managed care wherever possible is tempered by appropriate statutory exceptions in Section 3, which recognize differences in legal health status and local managed care capacity. To what I call the reimbursement benchmark, Section 4 of the bill, page 2, lines 41-42, deletes an existing statutory provision that was fundamental in the creation of the Oregon Health Plan in the late 1980s. And that provision reads, "The department shall solicit qualified providers or plans to be reimbursed at rates which cover the cost of providing the covered services." Section 9, which is euphemistically known as the benchmark provision, creates or replaces that principle of covering the cost of services with a process for developing a benchmark that can be used to compare the adequacy of OHP reimbursement to physicians, to hospitals, and to other health service providers. And it's primarily using Medicare, the nation's predominant public medical program, as the source of creating that benchmark. And it's done through the work of the Health Services Commission with the help of a consulting actuary. The purpose of the benchmark is to be able to compare a governor's proposed budget and the final legislative appropriation against an independent standard, Medicare. To the extent that state funding falls short of the benchmark, then OHP stakeholders, including members of the legislature, I believe will have an objective source of information with which to both compare previous funding levels and to seek improved funding where necessary. Physician care organizations. An old form of managed care is reintroduced into the OHP under the provisions of 3624. A physician care organization, or a PCO, is defined and authorized under certain circumstances. A PCO is an organized system of care, like a fully capitated health plan, but a PCO does not assume financial risk for inpatient hospital services. Hospital services are similarly covered for clients enrolled in a PCO as those enrolled in FCHPs and are managed by the physicians participating in the PCO. The hospital, however, bills the state for reimbursement through the fee-for-service system instead of the PCO.
Senator Carter, just say that to me. Don't read it. Say it to me again, what you just said.
Okay. From the point of view of an enrollee, they will the way this bill is envisioned to work, let's take Portland. There might be three or four fully capitated health plans, and in the case, and I'll get to the Kaiser situation, but in the case of Kaiser, a Kaiser PCO model. The benefit structures available to the members will be the same. What will differ will be the underlying reimbursement approaches. The PCO would be responsible on a capitated basis financially for everything but, for example, hospital inpatient services.
So what does that mean? That the view that the state would rather risk not...
The state will pay at the fee-for-service rate, which is lower than the rates that are built into the FCHPs. The state has potentially, you're right, some potential additional risk if utilization of the hospital changes. I would argue in the case of particularly Kaiser Permanente that there should be no change in that place. And in earlier PCO models, and we haven't talked with the agency about this, this could be developed through rulemaking, there could actually be incentives, that is withholds, so that if the state does see an increase in hospital utilization compared to its normal or mean fee-for-service population, then there would be a penalty for not managing that, assuming that the risks, you know, the health status of the populations were similar. So my testimony tries to lay out and answer the question that I believe you asked last Saturday, Senator Carter and Co-Chair Winters, was who's advantaged or disadvantaged? What I try to point out in my testimony is I don't believe anybody is disadvantaged unless you start from the premise that there's enough FCHP capacity in Portland that everybody could be enrolled in an FCHP.
Another question, answer, follow-up. So, Bonnie, tell me, let's say that you have, your beds are full of Medicaid patients. And if you were to call Emmanuel Hospital and say, Emmanuel, we're full, can you take some of our patients? How would you have to pay them versus how the state would be paying you?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, Kaiser Permanente has Kaiser Sunnyside Hospital, its own owned and operated hospital, and then has contracts with other hospitals in the area.
Okay.
We would, because our physicians would have to follow the patient to wherever the inpatient hospital admission would happen, we would use our contracted hospitals because our physicians are there. We have hospitalists in all of our contracted hospitals, so we would not be dumping a PCO patient that's under the care of a Kaiser physician into a hospital where a Kaiser physician is not available.
Oh, okay.
So but the hospitals, including Kaiser Sunnyside, would be reimbursed on a fee-for-service basis as opposed to what would happen under a fully capitated health plan.
So you'd be paying more for them to go to somebody else's hospital, and you'd have to pay them more than what the state is paying you.
Under the current FCHP, that is happening. What the PCO model offers, particularly for an organization like us, where we can't, what I use the term, make the market, is that the reimbursement levels would be the fee-for-service reimbursement levels at the state level. But the patient would continue to be managed from the physician's point of view and from the patient's point of view, just independent of that reimbursement differential. I hope that...
Senator Fisher.
Just so I understand this correctly, then your capitation rate, less the hospital services that are billed as fee for service.
Correct.
As to the
fully capitated health plans.
CMO,
right.
That would
right.
be capitated at a higher rate.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And I'll get into some of the rate issues for making sure that there's fairness, because that's one of the issues that our colleagues in the fully capitated health plan would like to see, and I'm supportive of that. In addition to the Kaiser issue, the PCO is authorized as a backup managed care system in two other narrow situations that I believe history of the last 10 years has pointed out there may be a useful need for a PCO model, and that would be in geographic areas where there are no FCHPs, and we know that in some areas of the state either FCHPs have left or have been unable to put together the full FCHP model in certain counties. This would at least allow the option of a PCO model to go into those areas of the state and bring a higher degree of management of physician services, prescription drug services, etc. In addition, it allows for the conversion of a FCHP to a PCO under very narrowly defined situations. In both these cases, the legislation would direct the Office of Health Policy and Research to create the criteria under which these can happen. They just can't happen willy-nilly, because one of the concerns I think we all have is to make sure that we preserve the FCHP's viability both as care delivery systems and financially. So it's intended, and I state in my testimony on page 2, while there's a concern among fully capitated health plans with the reintroduction of the PCO model, it has been acknowledged that PCO is preferable to fee-for-service for managing access and utilization and should be available in controlled situations, and I think the language in the bill tries to put those controls there. The Kaiser provision. Several members of the committee have read the bill, and I believe it was Senator Minnis Saturday that asked the question, who is that organization that's a prepaid group practice with over 200,000 members, et cetera, et cetera. That is Kaiser Permanente, trying to find language for a statute that describes us, and that's the best that I and the Legislative Council could come up with. It does, the provision does direct the agency to contract with us as a PCO, and we understand that in bringing the PCO model back to be one of basically three models used in by the Office of Medical Assistance, one being the current fully capitated health plan or full HMO, the PCO, and the fee-for-service, that there are going to be administrative costs of bringing that model up. And they're primarily programming costs within OMAP to be able to track eligibility and the capitation payments, et cetera. And we understand that the state is short of money, so we've made an offer to the state that in 2003 and 2004, in each of those calendar years, we would donate $50,000 per year, $100,000 total, and we believe that with federal match, which for administrative services is 2-to-1, and for IT programming services, I believe is 90%, be 9-to-1, that this contribution will help defray, if not all of the costs, most of the cost of making OMAP ready to administer a PCO option. The FCHP representatives who participated in the House deliberations were from Portland and Salem. They acknowledged the need in these communities for Kaiser's primary care system to provide access to OHP enrollees. If there were excess primary care capacity in those communities, then, as I said earlier, a Kaiser PCO would potentially disadvantage hospitals. But as it is, we see that we are taking, we're bringing new managed care capacity, albeit in a slightly different model, to a community, being able to, if you will, take more enrollees out of the fee-for-service, out of the fee-for-service system.
Bonnie, what population number are we looking at?
Madam Chair, currently at the kind of the apex of our experience with the Oregon Health Plan, Kaiser Permanente served in the Portland and Marion Polk County area in the area of 20,000 eligibles. Since our announcement last fall that we were leaving as of June 30th of this year, I think our eligibility now is down to around 8,000 or slightly less than 8,000. We have worked with the agency indicating we want to continue to serve those members on a fee-for-service basis and have had letters approved by OMAP and sent them to our members saying as long as they remain in Medicaid, if they're on fee-for-service, they can continue to receive their services from Kaiser. And we will work with eligibility workers, safety net clinics, and others to continue to participate in Medicaid on a fee-for-service basis. The fee-for-service basis is not the best model for Kaiser Permanente to work in. While we do and can bill for services on a case-by-case basis, we're not very good at it. And hence, we would rather play the game and be able to increase the number that we serve and potentially get back to the 20,000 that we served before than struggling to try to keep, if you will, the pipeline filled with fee-for-service members. I know one of the questions that was raised, it's been raised, if not publicly, it's been raised privately, is will a PCO, but in generally, or a Kaiser PCO, skim the cream and disadvantage the FCHP serving the same geographical regions?
Please talk about me, Madam Chair.
These are fair questions, and I've indicated to everyone I've talked to they're fair to be discussed about publicly. When an eligible person enrolls in the OHP managed care organization, they are given plan choices available in the community. We envision that the Kaiser PCO would be presented along with the FCHP available. There should be no distinctive difference from the current choice of Kaiser as an FCHP. We believe that the enrollee will choose based on the location of a medical office, other factors such as their style of HMO care and their familiarity with, for example, a prepaid group practice like Kaiser. In some recent discussions with an FCHP, I want you to know that we support an amendment that I have given to Chair Winters in conceptual form and that would state that the rates covered for covered services paid to a PCO, whether it be a Kaiser PCO or any other PCO that's ultimately authorized under this act, shall be developed using the same or comparable methodologies as those used to develop the capitation rates for fully capitated health plans and shall be established objectively to neither advantage nor disadvantage fully capitated health plans with respect to rates paid for similar services. In addition, Madam Chair,
Barney, yes. Have you seen this yet in any of the dashes that are floating around?
I have not seen all of the dashes available to me, but I did want to get it on the record that I do have a concept out there, and if it's can be amended by this committee or subsequently in Ways and Means, I would be supportive of that amendment. And in talking with my colleagues from the FCHP, I think it was all of our assumptions that this would be the practice of OMAP. We just want to make it crystal clear in statute.
Well.
Okay. I'd also like to that the capitation rates for certain populations are currently risk-adjusted by OMAP to recognize the uneven distribution of sicker populations, and I believe that risk adjustment should continue in the establishment of PCO rates. I believe risk adjustment is used for the disabled populations and the adult and couples populations, and I think that should carry forward. Prescription drugs. I don't have a lot to say about the prescription drugs. I will leave that to others, but I do want to say something that has come to my attention. And in reading 3624, particularly Section 11 in the A and Gross Bill, it relates to prescription drugs and the carve-out of what is in the bill talks about the carve-out of antipsychotics. And the question has been raised, can it be implied that antipsychotics are not carved out under the PCO prescription drug benefit? It's certainly not the intent. It was not even this concept of the mental health drugs, what's in the rate and what's not in the rate, was not even discussed. And I just want the committee to know and others who have concerns about this issue that whatever this committee's decision makes regarding prescription medications used to treat mental health diagnoses, the decision should be symmetrical. that is it should apply similarly to the FCHPs and the PCOs. And that was the intent when the PCO language was worked on. Lastly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to comment on Section 12. And you'll hear more in a moment on Section 12. This is the hospital policy section of the bill. I believe the genesis of this section is a long-standing controversy over what an FCHP must pay for hospital services when a contract is not in place. The budget cuts prompted by the failure of Measure 28 exacerbated this tension. Prior to the adoption of administrative rules, a year or so ago, some hospitals would require payment of bill charges when a contract did not exist. Others negotiated payments on a case-by-case basis. A couple of years ago, as I said, OMAP adopted a rule that the default payment in the absence of a contract is Medicaid fee-for-service rates. And what's happened as a result of the budget cuts over the five special sessions and the sixth special session this year, as fee-for-service rates are reduced due to budget constraints, the absence of a contract with an FCHP causes greater losses by hospitals. I believe the policy solution to this problem is not the language that's in the current Section 12, but is the establishment of a process, one, to assist FCHPs and hospitals to have contractual relationships, including non-binding mediation or arbitration, and two, an explicit default payment that is fairer than Medicaid fee-for-service. I know you'll hear later about some alternatives, and I just want you to know that Kaiser Permanente supports such amendments to Section 12 because I think these alternatives will address the true problem, and that the failure to treat and some of the other things are really symptoms of the absence of a good reimbursement standard. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer your other questions or be available to the committee at any time to help.
Any questions?
Just a comment.
Senator Carter.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that was a question I was trying to ask a few minutes ago. It appeared to me that since I raised the question of fairness and that further understanding about that provision, and only to find out that the state would pay Kaiser in a said instance, and on FCHP level, and then if they contract the hospitals, have to pay the commercial rate for that. So that was what I was trying to get straight, and that was the question that I was asked.
I hope, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I adequately addressed your issues.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3624, and we appreciate your work on efforts to continue the Oregon Health Plan. I want to follow up on Barney Spate's comments about Section 12 specifically, because it is that section that was most troublesome to Oregon hospitals when this bill was being considered in the House, and was the reason that we felt we needed to then oppose the bill. We are strongly opposed to Section 12 because it contains what is called a mandate to treat. And that is a provision that, as Barney has explained, that we think is punitive and unnecessary. With the assistance of the chair and the Senate Republican leader, we understand that there will be amendments presented, the Dash 10 amendments, I believe, that come up with an alternative payment policy that we think will address that issue. But I want to just explain why that provision, as it's drafted in the House bill, is objectionable. You've heard testimony both Saturday and Monday from witnesses about this issue, and I think you appreciate how controversial it is. But we urge you to read Section 12 carefully. It does not require that hospitals accept all FCHP patients at the rates that are set in the capitation payment. In fact, what it says is a hospital may not decline to treat a patient who receives health services from a fully capitated health plan providing health services under the Oregon Health Plan. That provision is not clear. Hospitals do not treat patients. Physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals treat patients. patients don't receive services from an FCHP. They receive services at a hospital from physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals. So the way the language is drafted does not express clearly what it is that hospitals would be expected to do and how they would comply with the provision. Oregon law for the existence of the Oregon Health Plan, as Barney testified, has contained an express requirement that health care providers would be paid at rates necessary to cover the cost of their services. This bill would replace that standard and remove the requirement that rates be necessary to cover the costs of the services. That's a critical element of the Oregon Health Plan, and if we're going to replace that principle, we think we should be as clear as possible about what the standard of payment will be. On the one hand, we might be able to live with Section 12 because we can argue that it doesn't really do anything or the language is sufficiently unclear that we could ignore it, but we don't think that's the appropriate public policy for the state. And for that reason, we would urge you to consider amendments that would take out the so-called mandate to treat and establish a clear policy of what will be required for reimbursement in the event that a health plan and a hospital cannot reach agreement in a contract. We believe that the Dash 10 amendments will resolve that issue in an acceptable manner and make it much more likely that we will have good working relationships among those components of the health care system, hospitals and fully capitated health plans or PCOs, that will help move the Oregon Health Plan forward again. Thank you very much.
Senator Carter. So where is the amendment that clarifies it? It's not subsection 2 of section 12 reads not. Which one is yours? I'm looking at your.
It would be the Dash 10 amendments. And when this, Madam Chair, Senator Carter, when this testimony was prepared, we did not have those amendments.
Senator Carter, at your packet, there are some amendments there. They may not all be there, but there are some that were ready.
Well, here it is. I got notes. Yeah, no question.
Follow up.
And Mr. Fade, you said in your, that you support the.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, yes. I've helped work with Bruce and other representatives of the legislature and stakeholders to try to find, one, define what's the problem, and two, what's the solution. I think this goes toward it. It's not. There's some additional negotiations because there's some blank lines that have to be discussed.
Third party.
Are you following?
Yeah, follow-up. Mm-hmm. Did you support?
Yes, and that's what I'm about to weigh in on.
Senator Menace.
What was the third question?
What if Barbara supported it as well?
Oh, okay. All right. Senator Chair, if I could, I'd like to have a little bit of discussion with respect to reimbursement issues, hospital reimbursement issues, fee-for-service, managed care, et cetera. I recently requested some information from OMAP regarding this issue and got what I consider to be a very brief and very unprofessional letter from Ms. Reed regarding my request and didn't honor the specifics or the details that it asked for. So could you enlighten the committee on the issues of how they set these rates and fees? To the extent that you have any clue.
Madam Chair, Senator Minnis, I'm probably not expert enough to be able to describe even in general how those rates are set. I can tell you what the statutory standard is for those rates.
Why don't you tell us what that is?
The statutory standard is that the state will pay rates that are necessary to cover the costs of the services.
All right, and those necessary rates are determined how?
Rates are determined by, first of all, the Health Services Commission does a prioritization of services, and then those services are costed out by an independent actuary that tells the state.
Kind of like an insurance company, the black box scenario.
Madam Chair, Senator Menace, yes, it is a scientific analytical process that I can't understand.
I don't know that you would be able to understand because so far the agency hasn't been able or willing to provide that information. And Madam Chair, subject to the response that I received from the agency, I have directed my council staff and judiciary to draft an amendment to public records bill that I have that would make it extremely clear that that black box is public information, public record. I'm also doodling here with some additional amendments that would discipline the Department of Human Resources for failing to provide the information, subjecting them to the Oregon constitutional provision that provides for up to 24 hours imprisonment for disrespecting the Legislative Assembly. Because I'm getting sick and tired of asking agencies for information, whether it's SAFE or whether it's DHS or anybody else, and getting thumbed. I'm getting sick and tired of it. And, Madam Chair, I'm going to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, I'm unwilling to move on much of this until I get the agency to begin to start cooperating. If it was me, I would dismantle the entire agency and sunset them and start over. Fire everybody in it and start over. Because I'm sick and tired. I'm sick and tired, literally, of not getting the information that we need to make good decisions. We're spending millions, if not billions, of dollars on information that is incomplete and intentionally incomplete. And I think it borders on criminal.
Thank you, Senator Menas. It really is important that we get the information that we request. Because that information does us allow to make informed decisions. And so I think the frustration of not getting information, whatever the agency may be, from legislative bodies, it doesn't bode well with us, whether we're talking about, say, for human services or whatever. We can't make good decisions without the information. So all of you who are listening know that legislators are expecting you to come forward with information that they request. And particularly,
and in addition to that, I am preparing subpoenas for the information. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber, here representing Peace Health, which includes Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, Peace Harbor Hospital in Florence, and Cottage Grove Hospital. I'd just like to weigh in opposition to Section 12 of the bill, this mandate to serve. To our knowledge, there is no comparable statute in any Oregon law where the provider of health care or any other services is required to serve all patients or all customers, regardless of their contracts. Doctors should not be forced to treat any and all patient, even if they have no contract to serve them. Clinics, pharmacies, nursing homes should not be forced to provide services outside their contracts. And hospitals should not be forced to provide services outside their contracts, with the exception of federally required emergency services, of course. So we urge you to delete the language in Section 12 of the bill and encourage you to replace that with the -A10 amendments, and the one caveat being there is a big blank line there dealing with the percentage of Medicare costs that would be reimbursed. If it's low enough, we would still oppose.
Mr. Barber, do you have written testimony? Or
I do not.
You do not? Just checking.
Thank you.
Want to make certain that we get everything on the record that deserves to be on the record. Are there any questions of Mr. Barber or any member of the panel with that? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
you were very clear on where you were on Section 12. Jeff Hetherington, Ruby Houghton, and Bill Murray. This is panel number 2. You have royalty in the middle.
Thank you.
That's, they always told me that. That color, it means royalty.
Thank you.
I had the question asked of whether or not we're going to work session this bill 3624 today. We are not, just so that those of you who may think that we were, it is not scheduled for work session. So,
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington, and I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated, an Oregon Health Plan contractor, fully capitated health plan, and also the chair of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is the association of all of the fully capitated health plans that are serving the Medicaid clients. That represents 13 plans and serving about 250,000 clients in 30 Oregon counties. I'd like to talk a little bit about 3624 in a sort of a big picture overview about the managed care delivery system, so that you understand a little bit about what it is that we're doing and how we do it. The House Audit Committee spent an awful lot of time on looking at how you can build efficiencies into the Oregon Health Plan, both in OMAP as a department and as into the medical delivery system. Their key conclusions were that access to care and care management, if it was planned right, maximized both the delivery of benefits and the expenditure of state dollars in the Oregon Health Plan. Second conclusion they came to was that in order to do that, you had to have an organized delivery system, and that basically the current delivery system of FCHIPS was such a system that should be enhanced. Third, and you've heard this, is that the cost of the program was not clear to the legislators and probably not clear to anybody else because of the rate-setting methodology and how the numbers were crunched, and they attempted to address that also in the bill. And that, an overriding theme was, in general, provider reimbursement in this program is low, and it does present problems in terms of access because providers don't like working for less than what their true costs are. I think we all acknowledge that that was a given, but it certainly was one of the ongoing problems in making the Oregon Health Plan successful. In terms of the FCHP, the Fully Capitated Health Plan Delivery System, I'd like to say a few things for people's edification. Number one is we are managed care organizations, and managed care is a label like light that you see on food. You know, it means many things to many different vendors. And in a lot of cases, managed care has gotten a bad name out there in the commercial world, meaning lack of choice and denial of care. But under the Oregon Health Plan, managed care is defined by three primary entities. Number one, the federal waiver, and what CMS puts in the guidelines. Number two, the OMAP contracts that they have with the fully capitated health plans. And number three, the administrative rules that OMAP develops and has developed over the years. The managed care requirements under the Oregon Health Plan that we all have agreed to are, first of all, that we have to have an organized delivery system in any geographic area that we serve. We can't just go in there and say, hey, we're here, pay us the money, and we'll see what we can do. We have to have an organized delivery system in place before we start the service. Second is that we have to guarantee capacity and timely access to primary and specialty physicians. And that's a pretty important part, both capacity and timely access. And frankly, the timely access rules are a lot better than I can get in my own healthcare, but that's part of what we have to guarantee, so that the patients are not disadvantaged in terms of getting in to see physicians. Third, we have to guarantee delivery of all covered services. So if we cannot get contracts or do not have the ability to deliver some of this stuff, we cannot organize in a geographic area. Fourth, there is a special emphasis in the contracts and in the rules on delivering prenatal care, prevention and immunization services, smoking cessation, and a whole host of other particular services that we and the department have agreed are important to this population. We are required to provide care coordination for complex and special conditions, which would be your exceptional needs people with diabetes, asthma, coronary artery disease, transplants, HIV, AIDS, hepatitis C, and non-English speaking patients. So There's a whole list, and these are just some examples. Yes.
I have a question because I see one issue that has been talked about a lot in the medical community of that we need to begin to address in this country, and I don't see it on your list, and that's the obesity. Was there any reason why that was not?
I'm probably the worst one to speak to that right now, but
I think a lot of us are.
And thank you for calling attention to it. Madam Chair, if you want an honest answer, it has not hit the radar screen in this program. I'm sure someone back there was making notes, and it will. But you are right; it is
a below the line diagnosis.
Oh, I am informed that obesity is a below the line diagnosis under the Oregon Health Plan.
It is.
Yes, it is.
Is it? Ooh.
Thank you.
I think it's the second behind tobacco nationally, and Oregon. The statistics on Oregon are not. In fact, they're higher than the national average. So that's kind of interesting that it is below the line, and it's one of a major health
issue.
Issue.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Obesity is mostly always behind.
Madam Chair. Senator Fisher is trying to be funny.
If I could continue.
You may continue behind that.
In all of these areas of delivery of services and access, the department monitors the fully capitated health plans for access, for quality, and delivery. And we have to report to them not only on a regular basis, but we also, there's ongoing monitors in place in case a plan develops, particular problems in a particular area. And I would say that, we have not seen plans who develop problems. There are things that pop up that we get questions on from time to time, but the department, does monitor very closely, how we operate and how we deliver the services. So in this regard, the fully capitated, the managed care portion, frankly, is pretty well defined and described by the department and by the federal rules.
You mentioned that the department monitors. Is there audit provisions in their monitoring?
Yes, and the audit provisions, some of them they do quarterly, some of them they do semi-annually, some annually, but they audit access, which we have to report on a regular basis. They audit performance measures in terms of some of the things I listed under special emphasis on delivery of care. They audit complaints that are made to the department or to the ombudsman. There's a whole long list.
Are there what about independent audit?
If you're talking about the independent financial audits, we're required to provide a certified public audit, independent audit, to the department on an annual basis. And then we do make quarterly financial reports, but a company like Simons & Evans or Price Waterhouse or Arthur Anderson, if they're still around, are required to do a certified public audit each year.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ruby Houghton. I'm the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for CARE Oregon and a member of COHO. I should have worn salmon color today, COHO. I want to go into some key advantages of FCHIPS, and thought that the first thing that I would share with you would be that we accept risk.
Do you have a question, Senator?
is that we accept risk. And I think that the question oftentimes comes up of how much risk can a plan accept, what patients, what kinds of patients. We actually have a population of clients that we accept risk for that oftentimes many other insurance companies would be able to weed out a little better than we are able to. We build and we maintain our physician network, and that takes a lot of work to continue to engage a physician community, nurses, doctors, etc., to continue to care for our clients. It takes a lot of work on our part, and we're very diligent in that work. We pay providers a little bit more than OMAP. In their fee-for-service arena. And that, again, people go to work to earn money, and so we have to pay them a little more to keep them engaged. And we direct the dollars for this population in the most cost-effective treatments and in the most cost-effective ways. We discourage our clients from going to the emergency room for a sore throat when they can go to their doctor. And so we're trying to do some education and training along the way as well so that we actually are able to direct the dollars where they're needed. And that ties into reducing the ER costs. We manage within the benefit package. And that's critical. It's important. And I get an opportunity to say that coming from Care Oregon because we've been able to pull ourselves back into alignment. And I'm happy to say that for many of you that our medical loss ratio has improved greatly. And then large-scale savings over fee-for-service. I think many of you saw the bit of work that was done by the department that basically told you that managed care is more cost-effective than fee-for-service. I provided for you some charts here having to do with what we do relative to caring for our patient population, childhood immunizations, the fee-for-service environment versus the plans versus the national averages. And I think you might say we have something to be proud of relative to immunizations. We also have something to be proud of relative to well child and adolescent visits. And again, emergency room visits as well. So I think that when you were asking the question, are we cost effective? The answer is yes. But are we effective in treating the population? The answer is also yes.
There are some key issues that show up in House Bill 3624 that have been addressed either at the dais or not. One of them, and I'm going to speak to one that we've heard, has not been addressed too much, is there's a concern about exempted populations not being put into the managed care system. And Representative Westland and Bates did testify, and we would concur that there is nothing in this bill which changes the current administration of exceptions. There are a number of people who appropriately do not belong under a managed care setting. The department has those processes in place, and this bill does not change those. And we would agree that they should not be changed. So we, for whatever assurances those are worth, we'd like to make that point.
Senator Curtis, you have two things I need clarification on and statements that you've made. One is that managed care can be defined in the same manner in which light on and it really came to mind because when we talk managed care at state, like you said, we're talking about waivers and those other things. When I think of managed care, I think about a Kaiser model where you have those doctors and managed care organization. You have the different doctors within that system, but then they don't necessarily manage the medicine, the everything across the lines. So when you guys, when you talk about Care Oregon, or when you talk about your system, what do you mean when you say managed care? And I think that that is very important because I can see why the rate issue would be an issue, Madam Chair and colleagues, because when we talk about managed care in one system, we might not necessarily be talking about managed care in another system. So what is the generally accepted definition of managed care in a language that we understand so that our partners understand that as well? And it sounds confusing to me, I should tell you.
Yeah, I would paraphrase a Supreme Court justice talking about another issuance as you'll know it when you see it. what I would say is that in terms of our definition of managed care is pretty much what you would find here in terms of the fully capitated delivery system and its requirements that are set up by OMAP. And that's why I went through on page 3. These are the requirements, and this is what managed care means in this environment. Managed care in a commercial environment might mean something totally different. And that's why we thought it was important to say, this is the picture for the Oregon Health Plan, which might be different than the picture for a commercial patient under Kaiser or under Regents Blue Cross. And this one is pretty tightly controlled, because what managed care means really under the Oregon Health Plan is guaranteed access and management of care. I mean, if you want to take it down to two fundamental things, that's what managed care means. We have to guarantee those.
Senator Menace, do you have a question?
Yeah, I guess the question, and shooting in the dark here a little bit, clearly there are private pay managed care programs out there, not government programs at all. And my assumption would be that there's probably likewise some actuarial data or analysis that goes into what the cost per patient would be in that program. Are there any studies or any analysis between, say, OMAP and or state or government run program versus a private run program on a fee for or per patient basis? I guess what I'm asking for, it's kind of a cash flow analysis. There's somebody's doing a cash flow analysis in this actuarial study that assumes certain things are going to happen within a period of time, and you have X number of persons within that portfolio or population, and you cap it, the per person cost, and you accept the risk to do that. You have private systems, public systems, and I don't know if public systems are more expensive on a per patient basis than private systems, or again, it gets me back to this whole information of not knowing how to make a good decision as a policymaker here, because I have nothing to compare it with.
Madam Chair and Senator Menace, if I understand the question, I think the answer is that essentially the public systems for the Medicaid population is more expensive on a per-person basis than you would find in the general population. And the reason for that is that these people, frankly, have greater health needs than the average populace.
Do we as a middleman serve as more of a, do we suck up more money in administration?
If you're asking about the Oregon Health Plan, I don't think so. In fact, I think you'd find that the administrative costs under the Oregon Health Plan are a lot less. I mean, we're generally at around 8%, and that's less than you'll find in the commercial market.
But I guess one of the questions I'm asking, if the cash that's going to pay the per-person costs flows to a managed care organization, as opposed to from the Legislative Assembly to OMAP to, you know, you cut out layers of government and administration, it seems to me there can be some savings or some parallels with respect to how the state's mental health system works. You run from, you know, the state system to the county system to the providers that provide for the county. Each time you go through one of these administrative layers, it ends up costing more and more money. So by the time you get to the patient, there's less money to serve their needs. I don't know if that's a coherent question at all, but I guess I don't, again, know where to go with the question to get it.
Madam Chair, Senator Menace.
I need light.
The light. The Senator, the studies that have been done by OMAP, and clearly we can show that you get more bang for the buck in the Oregon Health Plan system than you would be getting in an open card system, and that the providers, frankly, you're delivering more money directly to the providers of service under the FCHIPS than you are through the fee for service system. And the reason why that's happening, and the end user is really the beneficiary of that, both on the provider side and on the client side, because of access. The reason we can do that is because we make sure that the right provider, that the client gets to the right provider, rather than wandering around the system, and that there's not a whole bunch of extraneous services that are being used that are unnecessary or inappropriate to the condition, I think is probably the more important consideration. And I can give you, you know, primary care visits in a physician's office might cost, you know, $50 to $70. The same visit in an emergency room might cost you $300 to $500, depending on the charge.
I guess what I'm getting to is that it's highly frustrating as a legislator, whether you're dealing with criminal justice policy or you're dealing with health policy, because there doesn't seem to be any clear information provided to members to make good decisions with. You get a lot of tangential information. It's very fragmented. And I say that to say that one of the efforts in the criminal justice arena this session is through the Hatfield School of Government to actually get a hold of some legitimate evidence-based research to try to apply evidence-based research to criminal justice policy. I don't know that we have any kind of a research-based analysis that's independent, that's not OMAP, because frankly, I got to tell you, I don't trust them, that would give me clear information to guidance as a policymaker.
Madam Chair and Senator Minnis, you've come to my second bullet, which is Section 9 of the bill. And the Section 9 of the bill actually, you know, addresses that. It is a frustration for all of us that there was not an independent costing of this program. And so as the stakeholders and the legislators on the House side worked through that, basically what they said was that they wanted the Office of Health Policy and Research to develop, you know, the information that you're asking for. You know, what is the cost of the program? How is it, you know, how is it supposed to be apportioned out? And that information then is delivered to the legislature so that you have something to test against what OMAP does in terms of their budgeting.
Well, Madam Chair, state agencies generally treat us like mushrooms. And, you know, any state agency providing information to us, you know, I have got to view with suspicion. Because I haven't had any luck in my 18 years in this process getting people to agency directors or otherwise telling me the truth or consistent information or complete information. And I've been to co-chair of Ways and Means, and I've been a chair of Judiciary, and I've been in this process a long time. And it's not easy. So somebody's feeding somebody a line of horse manure.
We're going on a diet on this panel from the horses to... you know, this is serious. This is a serious issue on information and accurate information, whether we're talking the Oregon Health Plan or what, and it makes it extremely difficult. You know, I will ask the question. Nationally, as I understand it, that the trend is going more fee-for-service. So as a policymaker, I'm asking myself, if there are some movements going towards fee-for-service across the country, why are we going pushing managed care? Help me to understand as a policymaker the difference in what's happening in Oregon that is extinct, that is different than what's happening someplace else from a cost basis.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the trend away from managed care occurred as a result of people in the commercial market feeling like they were blocked from receiving care. And I think each one of us maybe had some experience where we can say, gee, I really thought I should have seen a blank, and I was told I didn't get to see that person. And the trend now is returning to, even in the commercial market, to understanding that we have to manage cost, and that there are going to be a lot of things out there that we can't eat. We need to be light. And in order to manage those costs, 44 of the 50 states use managed care for Medicaid. And so the trend actually is from a state-run program that managing the care of the population in this fashion and providing access and making sure that the individual gets to the right place at the right time, seeing the right provider, is crucial in maintaining good health. And I think the discussion of managed care, if you will forgive me this, I think that the words managed care, capitation, are very similar for me from when I served in this body and we used the word surcharge when I was a banker, those of you who were here then. We blew it. And we should not have used the terminology in that way. We should have talked about managing the care of individuals. We should have talked about people. We should have talked about human beings. And that's what this is. It's managing the care of people so that they can remain healthy or get healthy. And so, yes, 44 of the 50 states are using a managed care model for Medicaid, and that's because it works.
What are the cost comparisons on the six that do not?
They're going out of business, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You're all having financial difficulties.
Yeah, Madam Chair, address the, both questions you asked. I think one of the biggest problems, and certainly one that we have been concerned about here, is that when you see states transitioning, and this is a theory, this isn't, you know, from personal knowledge, but you can only take the rates that you pay to the managed care organizations down so low, and then they can't accept risk. And at that point, you do find them moving out of the system. And so I don't know what happened to those six states or whether they were in or not, but that certainly is a consideration.
I think it gets back to the question that's being raised by Senator Menace and myself of not having the ability to massage data and having...
In answer to that question, if I may, one of the earlier passes on Section 9 was not to put Hooper into the mix, but was to actually have legislative fiscal do the independent work from the actuary. Now, you all can figure out the politics of that, but frankly, if the legislature did their own independent work up front, that might give you a little bit better comfort level than having a different agency that you have do it. And I'm not making any recommendations one way or another on that.
Senator Menace, do you have another question?
Actually, I do have a question, but I want to say that I agree with Mr. Hetherington on the issue. I have for a number of years advocated that the Legislative Assembly actually invest in appropriate skilled staff to do just exactly the same thing, to be able to provide analysis apart from just the agency's information that's provided on a rather spotty level. The question I have is whether or not there's any analysis of the populations of individuals in fee-for-service versus managed care as it relates to the kinds of illnesses that they have. Would one be able to say that persons who are in fee-for-service tend to be healthier than persons in managed care, or that it's about even, or how do people get in and out of the system, and how is it that your costs are, I guess, unsustainable now? How is it that you're not doing well?
Madam Chair, Senator Menace, if you're talking about the Medicaid population, I'm not, I don't know how to answer that question. I don't have that information. The study that was done by OMAP, I don't know if they did disease categories. And my understanding is they didn't. They just took this population versus that population.
Let me ask this question. Ms. Houghton, how many AIDS patients do you have in care?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, CARE Oregon has 800 AIDS patients.
800? How many AIDS patients do we have in Oregon?
About 1,500? About 1,500.
1,500. So 800 of the 1,500 AIDS patients are in your program, correct?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Menace, that's correct.
Are they low-dollar or high-dollar patients?
Madam Chair, very high-dollar patients. Very expensive.
All right. And do we have a clue why they're in your program as opposed to a fee-for-service program?
Madam Chair.
We're just part of that black box.
Senator Menace, we're located in all areas of the state, primarily in the greater Portland area, where there are two very large, high-volume AIDS clinics.
Which gets me, Madam Chair, back to the reimbursement issue and the capitation rates and the whole issue of not being able to have information. It mystifies me as to why you have 800 AIDS patients who are high-dollar patients, and your reimbursement rates are not sufficient to sustain your revenue, your operation.
That's correct.
Moving on, I think Representative Westland and Representative Bates did a good job on talking about the integration of some of the mental health drugs into the fully capitated plans. We support that because we think it gives better coordination for the antidepressants and the anti-anxiety drugs. Most of them, as Representative Bates testified, are being delivered by our providers anyway. you know, this gives us the opportunity, particularly from the plan point of view, to see a patient's total medical history, which you currently don't have in the system. And has it got bourbon in it? Thank you.
She bring you some drugs over there.
Yeah. And some Xanax. It's below the line. So it gives better control. Yes. I'd like to talk finally about the Section 12 and the hospital access. The history on this is that going back to the fall of this year, we had one hospital system that started to limit the number of Medicaid patients that they were seeing. And basically what they were saying, unless you paid about 35 to 40% higher than what the Medicaid program generally pays, you couldn't put patients in their hospital. Well, those fees are not sustainable for any health plan. And so what some of the health plans have had to do is not utilize those services. Well, hospital system number two came along and said, whoops, and I think appropriated. So why should we have to take all of the Medicaid patients here? So they basically set their bar at the same level and then sent letters out to say, if you don't pay these prices, we won't see your patients. And then you have the third system, which is OHSU, which sees the majority of, I mean, a huge number of Medicaid to begin with, who said, no, wait a minute, because you've got now two tertiary care systems that say, we're not going to see these patients. So they're all going to be dumped on OHSU. So you had a domino effect here. And so that's why the mandate language went in. And I know that they say, well, there's no other provider that is a mandate. Understand that hospitals are unique providers in our community, number one. And number two, they are nonprofit agencies. And so as with any nonprofit organization, you know, there is a charitable purpose that has to be fulfilled. We believe that hospitals should be open to see any Medicaid patient, regardless of who they're with. And we also believe, and we would agree with some of the statements, that we don't want to be able to, you know, from the fully capitated plans, game the system and just, you know, pay them under the market. The Dash 10 amendments remove the mandate, which we would oppose, but they do have a payment schedule in there as a percentage of Medicare that we believe is certainly appropriate to the system, and we would be more than happy to work with the committee to insert that in. But without the mandate, you have the ability of a hospital in a community to totally tip over the managed care system. We never thought this was possible when we put this together back in 1985 and back in 1994 when we did the full Oregon Health Plan. But now what you've got is you've got hospitals making decisions that could tremendously impact state policy. And, you know, the big concern is Portland, because in Portland the hospital systems could decide to limit their Medicaid to such an extent that you would not have managed care. You know, and the cost, frankly, would be very high for the state. And you could get this anywhere in the state, frankly. But in your smaller communities, frankly, you have better working relationships, and a hospital simply wouldn't get into that position. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ruby and Bill Murray for any additional.
I don't think Bill is as long-winded as some other folks.
I'll just touch on two amendments that are going to come before you. The first one, Paul Cosgrove will be coming to you with the Dash A11s having to do with nursing homes. And I think there's a question of whether those institutional, the pharmaceuticals that are being supplied to those individuals in the nursing homes should be a part of our system, the fully capped system, as it relates to that. And the answer is no, we're not.
You're
going
talking
to
about the institutional pharmacies.
Right, institutional pharmacies. And the answer to that is no. Those individuals already have an exemption in the category that Jeff talked about, and we are still surprised that pharmaceuticals are not in that with them. So I hope that
I believe that amendments are being approved.
And that's what he's asking for. And so we are supportive of that. And then the mail order pharmacy language, I did have an opportunity to speak with them about this amendment, and the fully capitated health plans cannot support this amendment. However, we are very interested in working with them on a non-mandated approach to mail order pharmacy. Bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Murray. I'm CEO for one of the managed health care plans in the state of Oregon, known as Doctors of the Oregon Coast South, or DOCS. I will cut my testimony short, but I did jot down a couple comments. The first was with regards to managed care. Whenever I'm asked to speak, the first thing I really say is that I try to avoid the emotionally charged word managed care and prefer to say that we are in the business of coordinating care, and that means matching members and providers to ensure that there's the right care at the right time at the right place for all services that the state has chosen to cover. So I see us in the coordination business to make sure that those appropriate services get to the right member at the right time. Managed care, I think, has the era about it that it is denying services, coordination of care, and most of the time we spend in our office is actually ensuring and arranging access to care. Oftentimes we are involved in encouraging members to seek additional care, be it mental health services, chemical dependency service, or other services. And we also are consistently, through our management within the office, trying to see that members complete treatment plans so that we do minimize future costs to the system. So from my standpoint, we are in the coordination of care business to make sure that members receive all the care they need at the right place at the right time, with always in the background minimizing the cost. Also, when you have a coordinated system as we have now, I think in communities across the state, that coordination promotes participation. Because if you have active coordination, it means that those individuals are going through the system efficiently and more providers are willing to participate. We work very closely with hospitals, ancillary providers, physicians, non-physician providers. And so to me, that is really what managed care is when it relates to the Oregon Health Plan, is actually coordination of care. The other comment I'd make is in regards to rates. Rates are very difficult process. I probably know more than what I want to know about rates, and there's still a lot of unanswered questions. I think this bill goes towards trying to distinguish between what are actual costs and then what are actual payments that the state can afford to make. It makes a distinction between those two, which I believe is critical in this bill to understanding the value of services and then what the state can actually afford to pay. It clearly makes a distinction that has not been made before and has gotten blurry, and in that blur has caused a lot of frustration and animosity amongst providers as physicians say that hospitals are getting more and as hospitals say that physicians are getting more, and add on. So I think this bill directs both of those. It also encourages the system that has been very successful to date as far as encouraging and guaranteeing access to care and access to services. I think the alternative system, fee-for-service system, really may end up costing less, but it does it at the cost of access and quality of care and eventually the health outcomes of those individuals that are covered. I have one comment with regards to the Dash 6 amendment that I don't know if you have in your packets, but I've received up there. It addresses nurse practitioners, and I believe the intent is to allow nurse practitioners to be paid for their services when the nurse practitioner is more than 15 miles from a person or entity that the health plan actually contracts with. My concern with regards to that is that there appears to be no limitations whether or not those are covered services or whether or not those we have the ability to, once again, manage or coordinate those services. So my concern is that this needs to fall within the same rules that all other providers must follow. We try and contract with nurse practitioners. I think across the state, as there is a provider shortage, I think plans in general look to any available provider for services. So I think the concept of incorporating these individuals into the delivery system is good. I think there just needs to be caution to make sure that the same controls are in place so that we can fulfill our obligation of coordinating care. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mike Volpe, and I know he's in the back of the room. And then after Mike, I will hear the third panel, which is Ed Patterson and Karen Whitaker and Scott Gallant. Why don't you join the third panel?
Madam Chair, rest of committee, thank you for hearing this. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can, Mike. Well,
okay, my name is Mike Volpe, and I am here to speak as a person who receives care and has received care under the Oregon Health Plan for over 10 years, and I am also legally blind, and with the large amount of information that comes out at a very rapid pace, it makes it very difficult for me to keep up, so I'm probably going to be less able to speak to the details of the plan that you are currently looking at, and more able to speak to the generalities. Somebody like myself, who has been receiving care for almost 10 years, I have had one hospital stay during that time, and I credit that largely due to the complex network of care that I'm able to receive under the Oregon Health Plan as it exists for me right now. The network consists of pharmaceutical benefits, medical benefits, both physician and hospital stay, dental benefits, and also durable medical equipment. All of these interwoven together are able to provide me with the network of care that I need to deal with my complex case. I have had multiple sclerosis for 25 years, and during that time it has been chronically progressive. There are all kinds of health concerns that I need to deal with every day, and it's this network of care that is extremely important. I live in Corvallis, which is in Benton County. There is one HMO in our area, and I know that the two physicians which I see currently do not accept that HMO. So if it was necessary for me to go on the Intercommunity Health Network, then I would not be able to receive the care from my two primary care physicians. And that would put me in a very difficult position. Also, one of the details that I remember from the latest revised version of this bill that I have seen dictated that durable medical equipment for people who are categorically eligible would be reimbursed at 80% of the Medicare rate. The chair that I'm sitting in costs $13,000. If it was necessary for me to pay for 20% of that, that would come out to $2,600, and that's more than I can have in resources at any one time. but also a number of other durable medical equipment expenses that it would be very difficult for me to try to afford. So I think it's the difficulty that I have is trying to prioritize what do I want to have durable medical equipment over prescription drugs, over physician care, over hospital stay. I really cannot make that kind of a decision because it just isn't possible for me to sort out one particular type of the health care that I receive. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mike, and I think that the 80% is the rate that the state is saying that they would pay, not that it's transferred over to you on durable medical equipment, and I'll make sure I check that out with the agency, but I believe that that's what it is. You wouldn't have to pick up that 20%.
Thank you for that clarification.
Ed Patterson and Karen Whitaker and Scott Korsbaum. Leading off.
Apparently I am, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. Our association has about 66 organizational members, including 31 federally certified rural health clinics and 270 individual members. Our mission is to promote access to quality health care for rural Oregon. I'm here this afternoon to convey our association's support for the A6 amendments to House Bill 3624. The amendment addresses a serious problem that potentially exists for several of the isolated rural health clinics. As you know, as this committee certainly knows, how the managed care system works. A patient is required to be treated by a provider authorized by the managed care organization. The arrangement works well in most situations unless the provider is located in a remote rural community and is not a member of the managed care organization, such as a nurse practitioner who is the sole provider in an isolated rural community. If the nurse practitioner is prohibited from being a member of the managed care organization, then he or she must contract with a physician member of the managed care organization in order to receive a payment for services provided. This relationship creates several problems that threaten the ability of a rural health clinic to continue providing the service. And these are the examples that we're trying to address with the day six. If the physician charges a consulting fee to the clinic, which is more than the clinic receives in payment, the financial viability of the clinic is in jeopardy. Many rural communities have a large percentage of their population that is below poverty level, and travel can be difficult and access is threatened for the patients in that rural community. Oregon law allows a nurse practitioner to practice independently, and physician oversight is unnecessary and very expensive. The A6 amendment simply resolves these issues by requiring the Department of Human Services to directly reimburse a rural clinic operated by a health district, staffed by a nurse practitioner, and one that is more than 15 miles from another provider. We respectfully request the committee adopt the amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I direct the state's Office of Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University, and I am also here today to urge your consideration of the -A6 amendment to House Bill 3624. This is a very modest attempt to ensure that the most fragile rural health clinics are paid for their services. It is necessary for two reasons. Many managed care organizations do not recognize nurse practitioners as members, and the nurse practitioner must bill through a physician member of the managed care organization. And two, the federal regulations governing certified rural health clinics require that nurse practitioners have a supervising physician, regardless of the state law, which does not require that. Because the clinic already pays a consulting fee for that supervision, an additional consulting fee on top of that to bill through the managed care organization of which the physician is a member, often, and the failure to receive direct payment for services may result in a deficit situation for the clinic. So the clinic is actually paying money in order to see Medicaid managed care patients. We are asking that the clinic, if it is operated by a health district and if it is more than 15 miles from a capitated managed care provider, be paid directly by OMAP. And as you can see by the list that I provided for you, this is a small consideration and should not create a hardship for OMAP. There are just a handful of clinics that are involved here, and they are all isolated, small rural health clinics operated by health districts. Thank you for your assistance in this issue and for maintaining the viability of small rural clinics.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do not have written testimony. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I'll go through about 4 points very briefly, some of which you have heard before. One is the Medical Association believes, first and foremost, the goal under these difficult circumstances is to try to maintain as many people on the Oregon Health Plan as possible under very difficult circumstances. Two, as we have indicated to you before, we believe there is a significant capacity problem of having physicians provide services to Oregon Health Plan patients. As you know, reimbursement is horrible and may likely get worse, unfortunately. Our survey data, which we originally gave you last week, indicates that 60% of primary care physicians either do not accept or have significantly limited the number of Medicaid patients that they're accepting, and a huge proportion of physicians in 2002 decided to quit seeing Medicaid patients, and I think it's directly related to the reimbursement circumstances that we currently face. Having said that, House Bill 3624 has a number of concepts in it that we believe are very important. We believe that the PCO concept is an important provision to be included in this legislation as a backup mechanism under the rules that would be adopted by the Office of Health Policy and Research and by OMAP. We support the Kaiser Amendment specifically, included with the additional amendment, we think makes sense, and would encourage you to include that in the bill. The most controversial portion of the bill, obviously, is the, I believe, Section 12 legislation regarding whether or not hospitals must accept health plan patients if they do not have a contract at rates paid by by OMAP. I have seen the initial draft, the Dash 10 draft language, and I understand the intent of the proposal is to provide a structure that would force parties to sit down and negotiate a rate of reimbursement that is acceptable to both parties, but it is not binding under that proposal. And then there would be two potential fallback mechanisms for reimbursement. One would be billed charges, which you know, raises up my heart rate, and then some undetermined percentage of Medicare. The concern I have is what kind of impact this may have on the funds that are available to reimburse physicians, particularly in the metro
areas. Because, as you know, we've pretty well locked in rates for pharmaceutical costs and other areas, and the only fungible pool of money, if in fact the parties would agree to a higher rate of reimbursement for inpatient or hospital services, most likely would be the physician pool of funds. That may not be the net impact of this proposed amendment. I do have it, I'm having it analyzed, and I would encourage the committee to also request some type of independent, either OMAP or other analyses of what impact this might have on the other aspects of those who provide services under the health plan. Again, we know that this is an extremely difficult period of time. We would emphasize, again, that enabling health plan patients to be able to see primary care physicians is integral to holding costs down, and we hope that we will be able to maintain that system even in these difficult fiscal times. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth Byers and Ellen?
Madam Chair?
Representative Cruz.
Just a clarification. I was in another meeting and went back to my office and turned on my favorite afternoon television program, which is, of course, this committee, and heard the reference to the 80% of Medicare rate for DME. That is just the benchmark. That is not the rate, but that's to make sure the DME benchmark is relative to the other benchmarks that are in the bill. So I just wanted that clarification for the committee.
We're glad you came in, sir. We're glad that you're watching us on TV. Even more important, you could become a participant and come and join us.
Madam Chair, you look even better in person.
It could have gone all day. That's it. Ms. Beyer, would you begin, please?
Thank you so much, Chair Winters and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Byers. I'm here representing people who use these services, both through Project Equality, a consumer group of people on the Oregon Health Plan, and the Mental Health Association of Oregon. So I want to talk about capacity and my experience with the Oregon Health Plan. When the Oregon Health Plan started, I was on Medicaid. I had been working at the post office. It was going to be the last job I would ever need to have, and it was going to cover me for the rest of my life, and I was going to work for the post office. And I was a single mom with 8-year-old twin daughters, and I had a massive debilitating stroke. I was in the hospital. I was in rehab for 5 weeks. They sent me home and said, order your wheelchair. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. That was my personal challenge to myself. And now you would say that I'm probably had never been ill, and nobody can really tell. And that's too bad in a way, because I'm really a representative of what really good rehabilitative care can do and allow me to become a full-time employee again. So as my experience in 94, I had been on Medicaid after leaving the post office. I'd been on Medicaid for about a year, and no doctor would take my Medicaid card. I was able to get care for my kids, but I wasn't able to get care for myself, and really never knew once I left the post office and left my good top federal insurance. I never saw anyone ever again for any kind of services related to my stroke, so I'm kind of a healing miracle. So the first thing that happened when we heard about the Oregon Health Plan, families on Medicaid, we got together, we said, let's get a doctor. This was the most exciting thing we ever heard. We got a thing in the mail that said, here's 120 doctors in the Marion Polk area who are going to take Oregon Health Plan and who they're affiliated with. We had to pick a managed care plan But we didn't want to do that without some education, so we called the doctors to find out what managed care plans they were with and what their specialties were. And out of the 120 doctors, we actually were able to reach the offices of 40 of those doctors. The other offices left us on hold for more than 5 minutes, so we didn't stay waiting for them. But we did talk to 40 doctors, offices, and staff, and out of those 35 of those provider offices told us they weren't taking Oregon Health Plan. Two of them were pediatric clinics, and they said they would take us if we were under 2 weeks old, and none of us were, so we didn't bother to call them back. And the last two were, said that they would see us if we could pass a credit check. Now, every one of us had been on Medicaid for more than a year, and, you know, if you're disabled and on Medicaid, you usually don't have any credit, so we didn't bother to pursue that. Ultimately, there was one doctor who said he would take new patients on Medicaid, and we all went there until he had to give up his practice in a year because he was elderly and needed to rest. So we took our findings to a Senate subcommittee, I think very similar to this one, and 93, and they said, well, or 94, said, well, you're not asking the right questions. You're supposed to call your managed care plan and have them find you a doctor. Well, our concern was at the time, if these providers didn't want to see us when we called, how was our relationship going to be with them when their managed care plan or the source of their income forced them to see us? So we were very concerned, and still, in fact, I only ever had access to immediate care clinics. I never actually again saw a physician when I was on Medicaid. Luckily, I was able to recover and go back to work full time, and now I have coverage through my employer, so I'm lucky. But there's a lot of folks out there who aren't as lucky. I'm going to give you some examples, a little bit of other people's stories that I know about, and I hope then that you'll be able to ask questions that these narratives are going to hopefully bring to mind. I can tell you that a lot of the work I've done in the past is in Lincoln County, tiny little rural county at the coast. I love the coast, so I love working there. And one of the things that I did was work very hard to encourage families to put their children into the state's Children's Health Insurance Program. And we worked really hard with different cultures in that county and different individuals in that county, and found, by and large, an overwhelming number of the people said to us they would not sign their children up because they felt that there were no providers that would see them in that county, and that really concerned us. I'm hearing even now that in Lincoln County there's only one doctor who will see the Medicaid enrollees in that county. That's about 4,600 folks on the Oregon Health Plan at this time in Lincoln County. And Lincoln County, while narrow, is fairly long, and people are driving maybe 50 or 60 miles round trip to see that one provider. Other than that, they're driving to Salem. And they're driving to Salem in dangerous vehicles, that, and they don't really have the resources to do the drive. Then they don't go. So here's folks that were that have coverage, theoretically have access, and really don't have appropriate access to see a provider. In all the time that I've worked with the Oregon Health Plan, it's been my experience that probably at any given time, in the best of circumstances, which for me was Oregon Health Plan 94 to 97, even in the best circumstances, I'd say at any given time, maybe even as many as 50% of the people who are enrolled in capitated plans do not have access. They cannot find a doctor who will see them in a timely manner. It's very disturbing. There's also things I want to talk about for people who are in managed care who are disabled, and I'm really privileged in my work to meet a substantial number of people who use Oregon Health Plan because they're disabled and not because they're income eligible. When I talk to those folks, they're telling me things about managed care that really concern me about managed care for people who are disabled. And I think it's really important to note that that's the primary population that's going to be affected by this bill. People who are disabled have peaks and valleys, sometimes needing more services, sometimes needing less, and a lot of times needing to be able to communicate effectively with one primary care provider, whether that's a family physician or the specialist that addresses their particular illness. And within managed care, it's very difficult to understand who are the specialists on the panel, how to reach them, and when you make a choice about a panel or a plan, there's no guarantee that you'll even then have access to the provider that you need. But my concern, too, it has to do with people who are disabled. When they need more care, they are not going to benefit from the managed care process, which works best with people who are healthy and don't need costly interventions. I'm very concerned that when you put people who are disabled who have lots of challenges and need more care than healthy people, that those folks are going to fall through the cracks and not get care. I have an example of a man that I worked with who was a triple amputee. He had had a leg, an arm, and part of his remaining hand were severed, and he was in tremendous pain all the time from phantom limb pain. I'm not a doctor. I don't really know how that works, but what I understand about it is that it's pain that you feel in a limb that isn't there anymore. And I was actually at an event that Project Equality was putting on in Portland, and a man wheeled up to me and he said, "I'm in tremendous pain all the time and my managed care plan will not give me painkillers." And I said, "Well, that doesn't seem right. Maybe there's something I can do to help." So with his permission, I called into the managed care plan, talked to member services. They transferred me to an exceptional needs care coordinator, which is built into the managed care plan to help people with disabilities. I talked to the exceptional needs care coordinator and explained this person's problem, explained that I had their permission to talk, and talked to him about phantom limb pain. Well, the ENCC said right off the bat, that's what we call the exceptional needs care coordinator, said right off the bat, "Well, you know, we don't provide pain meds for people with phantom limb pain." I said, "Well, that's fair, and maybe according to best practices, I don't know, but if there must be a protocol for helping people who are triple amputees." She said, "Triple amputee?" Got to looking in her records, found that this person was in fact a triple amputee and needed very specific kinds of care that he was not getting. She put me through to the pharmacy benefit manager. I had literally the same discussion. "Well, we don't provide that kind of service for amputees." I said, "Well, there's got to be a protocol then of some way that you address phantom pain." She said, "Well, not really." I said, "Well, and why does this person warrant it?" I said, "They're a triple amputee." Triple amputee. So even though we have this incredible access to these extra people within the system, they're not able to do the more time They're unable to do the work that takes the most time to determine who's not getting services that they need. And I'm very concerned that as we put more and more people into managed care, in fact, there's less and less care. The other thing I want to bring up is that within this environment of managed care, if a provider is not happy with their interaction with a client, they can say that this client is dismissed from our practice, cannot come back to this clinic or whatever the practice is, and that person is then trapped in managed care, so they cannot see a fee-for-service provider, but their managed care provider will not see them. This was a very, very sadly illustrated to me by a person in a rural area who had been in a wheelchair for the bulk of their adult lives, from 16 to 40. And at 40, they came in contact with a provider who, through some very new narcotic therapies, was able to give this person enough relief from pain so that they were walking and not using their wheelchair. In a related incident, the physician practice decided that patient was too disruptive, was not allowed to be a client there anymore, and that person had to go through the withdrawal of those narcotic pain meds by themselves, alone, ultimately ended up in the hospital. It's just not it's not always an appropriate environment for people with disabilities, and we need to have a way for people with any kind of issue who need to be fee-for-service to allow them to have that access without losing Oregon Health Plan coverage. The other thing that I'd like to say, and hopefully there'll be you'll have questions for me, is I'm very concerned that we're talking about managing antidepressant medications. I'm especially concerned because we have a population of people right now who take antidepressants, who have tried and failed on antidepressants that didn't work for them, and have now developed a real understanding of what works for them and what doesn't. If we now put them into a pharmaceutical managed care environment where they have to again try and fail on other meds before they can get back to the med that works for them because of this management process, I think we're going to lose a lot of people. I'm afraid that people will get worse, be in hospitals, and ultimately use what they might believe is their only resource for relief, which would be suicide, and I'm concerned about that. And I appreciate this time, and I've got a lot more examples if you have there is one thing I wanted to tell you. Remember Patty Ann from Scappoose, who came and testified last week? One thing that she didn't talk about and is that she was a year ago living in a homeless shelter, and she got the opportunity to get rent stabilized housing. She was in Multnomah County. She wanted to stay in Multnomah County, but she got a housing opportunity of her own place, and she moved to Scappoose so that she could take advantage of that option. And in doing so, she lost access to her mental health provider because at this time we're to save money, really making limits about where people can go for services. And once she left Multnomah County, she lost access to the provider who got her off the streets through homelessness and into home fullness. And she's really suffering as a result. The other thing I wanted to tell you is
can you sort of bring it to a close here?
Okay, one more thing, and that is that now in Multnomah County, people who have been fee-for-service are being just put into managed care plans. The problem with this is they have treatment plans arranged already with providers that were fee-for-service. Now they can't see those providers, and so their treatment plan is lost to them. They have to start new relationships with new providers. They had no notice that was going to happen, no transition time, and now in this this unfamiliar environment where they don't know how to get services and don't already have providers. Thank you so much, and I hope that you have questions for me.
Can we go now, you, Ellen?
Sure. Thank you, Senator Courtney. My name is Ellen Pinney. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign. We believe that managed care can work and should work to improve access to necessary services in a timely manner, because managed care really should be about making sure that folks get into primary care in a timely manner, and it's about coordinating care. Indeed, we've heard from communities across the state as managed care plans have folded up and left their communities, from people working in outreach and enrollment, from the safety net, that they are very concerned about access for folks left in fee-for-service. The only reason to require all people to enroll in Medicaid managed care is because we believe it will improve access. Improved access means reduced cost to the state. But there is nothing in this bill that allows us to evaluate whether, in fact, this bill will result in improved access, or even more basically, to evaluate whether access will continue to be a component of whether access will continue to be provided. And we would encourage this committee to consider benchmarks related to access in addition to the other benchmarks that you have in this bill. And I will come back to that in a minute. A lot of discussion around the Oregon Health Plan has focused on making sure that the Oregon Health Plan should look more like the private market, that people enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan should have benefits that look like private market coverage. Copays, premiums, penalties for failure to pay premiums have all been imposed. In the spirit that the Oregon Health Plan should look more like the private market, I would offer a suggestion that any managed care entity contracting to provide services to people on the Oregon Health Plan should be required to incorporate the Oregon's patient protections that are part of managed care plans that work in the private market. I will mention a few that I think are most relevant for this population and for this bill. One is the right to file a grievance with their plan, in addition to a right to request a hearing with an OMAP. Their right to have information about the network and service area restrictions of their network, how to obtain emergency care, the hospital doctor and clinic network guide, assistance that's available to non-English speakers. This is a big issue for us, because if, in fact, you do have a choice of managed care plan, which I would submit to you that most people living outside the Portland area do not now have, and most people living outside the Portland area don't have a choice of managed care plan. But if you are fortunate enough to have a choice, you should be able to get a list of providers on your plan and some information about which of those providers speak other languages, so that you can get access to a provider who speaks your language. In addition, Oregon patient protections require that information is available upon request to enrollees, things like provisions for referrals for specialty care, the grievance activity of plans. This kind of information should be available to managed care enrollees in the Oregon Health Plan. Patient protections in Oregon.
Question, Mr. President?
Senator Carter, please.
Senator Brown.
Ellen, thank you. My question is, I'm assuming that most of these are part of federal law?
Senator Brown, not all of them are a part of federal Medicaid managed care law, and I am concerned about that particular piece as well, because last time I had a conversation with OMAP about whether or not we were going to adopt the federal Medicaid managed care requirements, I was told that we were operating under a waiver and that therefore we did not need to adopt those provisions. And I would also suggest, Senator Brown, that the federal government, CMS, has said that its Medicaid managed care requirements are a floor. And there are some patient protection provisions in Oregon law that go beyond the floor required for Medicaid managed care.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes, please.
Thanks. So you would like to see these explicitly in the bill that we pass. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Brown.
Thanks.
I could continue to go on to read some of the ones that I'm specifically concerned about. For example, women. In patient protection laws in Oregon, women age 40 or older can have a preventative routine annual mammogram without a referral from their primary care provider. That maternity and newborn care requires a minimum hospital stay of 48 hours. I mean, I don't feel like I need to read all of these pieces because many of you are involved with enacting them. I think at a very minimum, people on the Oregon Health Plan required to enroll in Medicaid managed care should have access to those basic patient protections as well. In addition, in the federal Medicaid managed care law requires that enrollees have the right to receive information regarding their health care, be treated with respect and due consideration, receive information on available treatment options and alternatives that is presented in a manner appropriate to the enrollee's condition and ability to understand, including cultural and literacy issues are raised. And I just really encourage this committee to look at ensuring that people on the Oregon Health Plan required to enroll in Medicaid managed care have at least those provisions that we provide, or those protections that we provide to the privately insured in Oregon, and if not that, at least federal Medicaid managed care provisions. In addition, I would like to add another protection. I believe that all plans that agree to offer services in any geographic area should be required to be open to all zip codes in that area. If they close to any one zip code in an area, they should be required to close to all. The issue here is creaming or skimming of zip codes and populations that are high risk. And I have to be honest and say I don't know the extent to which this is a problem, but I have to say as an office that provides application assistance, I can't tell you how many packets we open that say if you live in these zip codes area, in these zip codes, these plans are not available to you. If in fact that provision is not one this committee is willing to consider, I think it would be appropriate to require an evaluation component that at least addresses why plans that choose to close enrollment in certain zip code areas have chosen to do so. I would like to go back to evaluation. The bill mentions in its preamble, it talks about determining benchmarks for setting per capita rates for reimbursement of health care services. And I have to say that I'm a little disappointed that there is no mention of setting benchmark for access, access for primary care, and access for people with special needs. That serve as a tool for evaluating whether or not contractors or plans should be maintained as contractors for the state of Oregon. If you look at Section 2, Subsection 1, it talks about the entity being able to assign an enrollee to somebody, basically a primary care provider, but there's no reference, for example, of that primary care provider's ability to see that patient in a timely manner. That's the kind of access provision that I'm referring to. In your exemptions for people, exemptions, you list Section 3 lists exceptions, people who do not have to be mandatorily enrolled in managed care. You have under D, a person under 18 years of age who is medically fragile and who has special health care needs. I don't know why there should be an age limit on that provision. It speaks to another exemption being, obviously, a person should not be required to enroll in managed care in an area where there is none. But I would add to that that a person should not be required to enroll in managed care in an area in which that managed care plan has a very limited number of providers, if any, that are open to new enrollees. So I think there needs to be some look-see at if a managed care plan claims it's open and it has only one provider, kind of what that does to access and to the feeling of the enrollee. We have heard from enrollees in some cases that they feel where there are very few providers that are available to them, that there's a reason for that, that none of us would choose those providers as our primary care providers. So I think there needs to be some look at that. Also, I think there needs to be some acknowledgement that providers can and do dump patients, and there needs to be an ability of those patients to continue to get services from providers that are willing to see them. In Section 5, it directs OOPR, Office of Health Policy and Research, to develop criteria for a number of things, including evaluating, I think, criteria for determining when OMAP may contract with a physician care organization. And one of the criteria is that the PCO must be able to assign an enrollee to a person or entity that's responsible for coordinating the physical health services. I would add to that in a timely manner. So here are some of the evaluation components, and I'm thinking that OOPR would report to some committee on a bi-monthly basis, potentially, by managed care plan or managed care entity, categories of people enrolled, zip codes of their enrollment, compared to poverty indicators of those zip codes, for example, languages of their enrollees, number of primary care providers with which those plans contract, how many of those primary care providers have practices that are open, and if they are open, what is the capacity of those primary care providers at that particular point in time. We'd like to see encounter data be part of the kind of evaluation, the benchmark evaluation, encounter data, visits with primary care providers. For some subset of people with disabilities, visits to specialists, and emergency room utilization by category. Finally, I would add that we are pleased when managed care plans, I believe DOCS and I know Care Oregon, had consumer advisory panels. We think, despite some who might claim that consumer advisory panels add to bureaucratic burden and administrative overhead costs, that truly consumer advisory panels that with a cross-section of people with disabilities are vehicles for the plans to improve the access that they provide, and that managed care plans should be required to have consumer advisory panels in every area in which they operate. Care Oregon, until recently, had a statewide consumer advisory panel. They brought in folks from across the state. That's laudable, but I would suspect maybe even more costly than having local advisory panels that get at local issues. Finally, I would say that the reason I believe that evaluating access and creating some access benchmarks is critical if we are moving to a place where we are requiring Medicaid managed care enrollment is because if, in fact, people cannot get access to primary care providers, this plan becomes a hospital emergency room plan only. And if it's hospital emergency room only, why are we paying for access that is not being provided when we should just be going back to fee-for-service? Not that I am a strong supporter of a model that gives people access to emergency room services only, but clearly the promise of managed care is that people have access to primary care that keeps them healthy and keeps them out of the emergency room. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. May I ask, please?
I want to make a statement here consistent with my earlier statement, but Ms. Penny, you're absolutely right on a number of points with respect to regulation, and one of the things that during the special session we found fascinating was to the extent that the state engages in a waiver process for Medicaid, and you have a Medicaid waiver program, you don't adopt the federal regulations. And if you don't have any state regulations, hence the thing is unregulated. So getting back to my original point, if you don't have access to information because they won't give it to you or it's not there or it's jumbled and scattered and not available for any number of reasons or who knows what, the legislature, who's stuck in the middle of this having to fund it, doesn't have access to information to even evaluate the many statements that you made with respect to how the program should function. So we've got to get first things first, and I think when we start talking about waiver applications and Medicaid program and our relationship with the federal government, the legislature needs to spend more time evaluating the very questions that you ask. I'm not sure that they fit in the context of this particular bill at this time, but I think Ms. Penny makes an extremely important point that should not be dismissed by the legislature, that this program is by and large unregulated by the federal government since it's in a waiver program, and it is by and large unregulated by the state legislature or state law. And hence you have an agency that is almost impenetrable in terms of information. And it's a real paradox.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Minnis, if I could just respond by saying I appreciate your support for some of the things that I said. I would, however, really urge you to consider what might be appropriate to add to this bill now, given that this seems like an opportunity to ensure, first of all, that if people are being required to enroll in Medicaid managed care, they at least have the patient protections that are required under federal law.
Ms. Penny, the only reason I disagree with you at this point is we have no data or information to even evaluate whether it's a good decision. We wouldn't know. So if you adopt the law having absolutely no information or data, it encumbers you down a path that you have no basis on which to go. In other words, I would rather develop the policy and then evaluate it through some legislative mechanism that actually oversees what's going on and then develop those practices.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Minnis, then if the patient protections, I can understand that. If patient protections are not pieces that you would like to consider, then it would seem that at least an evaluation component around access should be added to the many evaluation components around reimbursement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Elizabeth. We're getting to a time crunch. I'm going to call Josie Cheney, Dan Looney, Stephen Loggia, and I hope the rest could come back tomorrow, please, because we're losing members. So, and I know there's been a lot. Some of you have been here a while.
Could we include Angela Kimball from NAMI in this panel? Is that possible?
Well, you can, but I'm going to tell you, at 5:30, we're in trouble. We're in trouble because that's all I'm trying to do. I thought someone had testified before, but that's fine. Let's give it a shot because I'm down. Well, and it's not fair to you if most of the members aren't here in terms of your testimony, so I was just trying to.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter, please.
While they're coming forward, it's just that we have so many meetings that we're trying to attend to while showing respect to this committee as well. So for many of us, forgive us for having these other meetings that's going on.
Josie, do you want to go first, please?
Yes, my name is Josie Cheney. I'm from Southeast Portland, and my comments should take approximately 3 minutes. First, I wanted to thank senators and representatives for looking for ways to maintain a system of health care for the underserved. I would, as we talk about prioritizing care, I'd like also to talk about prioritizing allocation of common funds. One specific example, actually reclaiming funds for the general fund to balance the budget. Within the past couple of months, the smoking cessation program was stopped to reclaim the $4 to $5 million that was left in for that program to the general fund to try to balance the budget. And I would say that that's a drop in the bucket compared to funds that are still being decided upon via HB 5042, the remainder of the $200 million that is supposed to go to the Oregon Opportunity Fund for the OHSU biotech expansion is still in the balance. That's $106 million. That's a substantial amount that could actually help provide these services. And if you are increasing the efficiency of these services, then it would provide even more value. I think that this is an emergency that we should look at reclaiming possibly even the rest of the funds allocated by SB 832. And I do not think that this investment will bring the return to Oregonians that they are saying it will. And in fact, the stated benefit to Oregonians is really the only explicit amount is $10 million in income tax, an increase in $10 million in income taxes, which would be partially or completely negated if we go through with a bill that is backed by Ryan Deckert, which would give, which would make researchers completely income tax exempt for a number of years if they brought in around $200,000 a year in grants. So that in itself would chip away at the only quantified benefit of the Oregon Opportunity Plan. So I would like to urge you, as we're looking for ways to become more efficient and to try to maintain these services, to look at funds that we can bring back into the general fund. If we can stop a successful smoking cessation fund, which actually, I mean, which actually does benefit people, for $4 to $5 million, we should be able to look at a $106 million amount and say, well, how can this more directly serve Oregonians? I think it can more directly serve Oregonians by building clinics and staffing them and providing health care to people, or funding schools, something that would more directly and substantially benefit people in general. So,
Dan Looney?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Looney.
Oh, Don.
Yeah, I live in Oregon City. I don't have a lot of clout as far as, you know, talking about politics and that. But I wanted to thank you for restoring the Medically Needy program. Unfortunately, my best friend committed suicide when his meds got cut off for AIDS. And, you know, maybe that, you know, was how things were supposed to be, but it's just too bad that it happened. I am very fortunate. I have Care Oregon as my provider, and I'm most fortunate as a mental health consumer to live in Clackamas County. I don't know the whole logistics of it, but I know there was a lawsuit by Clackamas County some years back to maintain their mental health system and the way they worked it, instead of turning it over to a for-profit organization. And because of that, it's an exceptional county. I think that the entire nation could model their mental health service after Clackamas County.
I'm certain that Melinda would echo those sentiments.
I didn't know what Don was going to say.
I didn't either. Anyway, that's all I had to say, and thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Angela?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Courtney, and members of the committee, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill would, first of all, like to express its rather profound gratitude to the committee for its inclusion of mental health, chemical dependency, and prescription coverage as part of the basic benefit package for all who will be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. And while the issue of funding is not yet resolved, we would like you to know that your commitment to treating disorders of the brain with the same urgency as other medical conditions gives our family members a tremendous feeling of hope and comfort. And perhaps more importantly, by doing so, you have reduced the burden of stigma and feelings of unworthiness that come when mental illnesses are treated differentially or not at all. We would also like to applaud the extensive and admirable efforts that went into preserving the Oregon Health Plan through House Bill 3624. We understand the need to restructure some aspects of the plan in order to realize the goal of maximizing the number of individuals who will be covered. However, we do have concerns about how the current language may affect the care of those with serious mental illnesses. First, Sections 10 and 11 would exempt only antipsychotics from management by health plans. It is precisely because primary care physicians prescribe the vast majority of these medications that we support medication cost controls that focus on physician education and improved quality of care. And the very need for targeted education of primary care providers suggests that those with extensive experience and expertise in mental health care are those best equipped to manage them. And secondly, while mental health organizations are referred to in House Bill 3624, the language of Section 6 and throughout the bill leaves the legislative intent for the delivery of mental health services unclear. And this lack of clarity is unsettling, as the needs of the seriously mentally ill are often not well met by traditional healthcare organizations. For example, I was just contacted by a family whose 12-year-old son was recently hospitalized and diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He was discharged home, and the lone child psychiatrist available on this family's health care plan disagreed with the diagnosis. Their boy was taken off of all his medications and put on Prozac. As I was told, he went berserk and started hurting his little sister. He had to be hospitalized again. Now our hospital coverage is exhausted, and they want us to sign over custody to the state so that he can be discharged to the children's farm home for more treatment. And I offer you that story because it is critical to understand who and how public mental health services are going to be delivered. And we'd like you to capitalize on the expertise and resources that have been building in our community mental health programs. And while the development of these mental health organizations may vary throughout the state, I'd like to remind the committee members that the very field of community mental health is relatively new and historically underfunded. Nevertheless, some of our community mental health programs have been making critical strides in responding to the needs of consumer and family members, in developing partnerships with law enforcement, courts, school systems, and residential providers, in developing effective programs such as their early assessment and support team, which provides early intervention for those first suffering from a psychotic break, and by investing in supported housing. And I can tell you this, the consumers and family members who filled up the church parking lot last night while attending a Clackamas County NAMI meeting would be most distressed if they were to lose the local input and connection that they enjoy with their county's mental health organization. With these concerns in mind, we simply ask the committee to please give consideration as to how those with serious mental illnesses will receive their care under House Bill 3624. Again, we're deeply appreciative of the attention given to mental illnesses and have no doubt that the intentions of this bill are to provide well for the needs of those with serious mental illnesses. Thank you.
Thank you. Stephen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stephen Loaiza, and I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Oregon. And I would like to echo Angela's concern. I applaud the efforts of the legislator working to put this bill together, but there are areas that are very unclear. There's areas where there could be some more oversight. And one of the key things for us is the inclusion of all mental health medications, open access to medications, and in this particular bill it mentions the antipsychotics, but I have to tell you the antidepressants, the anti-anxiety, and the anticonvulsants are key components to the recovery process. I didn't come here to laud Clackamas County, but I happen to live in Clackamas County. My son has been a member of the Oregon Health Plan and involved in Clackamas County mental health, and if you want a model of one of the good things that are happening around this state, look at Clackamas County Mental Health. I can mention others. Eastern Oregon State Hospital, Maxine Stone runs a wonderful facility over there. The EAST program down in Salem. Lane County is doing some wonderful things. So community mental health providers have the expertise, they have the experience, and the talent to make this possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to close the hearing, the public hearing, and we'll have a reconvene tomorrow. Sorry, Melinda, after all those kudos that you got and how wonderful Clackamas County is doing, you know. But we will reconvene tomorrow. We still have a number of individuals who have signed up. We're meeting at what time tomorrow?
3:00.
At 3:00 tomorrow, same place. Senator Carter.
When do we meet again for public hearing?
Tomorrow.
Other than tomorrow.
If there's a huge list, then you will be coming back the next day.
The reason I was asking is because I do know that there's a regional meeting for mental health directors. And
when is the meeting, Melinda?
1:30 to 3:30 tomorrow.
Here or first?
Veterans Street.
1:30 to 3:30. So you can be here tomorrow.
I will try to be here later in the afternoon.
I mean, since you received all the accolades, not unless you have a 5-minute testimony, you can do it right now.
My testimony is very brief.
Come right on
Thank
up
you.
Here. I mean, anyone who has all those accolades and everyone says how wonderful you are. Or I should say Clackamas County's program.
I can, and for the record, Senator Winters
Members of the committee, my name is Melinda Mowry. I will. I have submitted written testimony. I can reduce that down to its essence. My concern was touched on briefly by the previous panel, and I think that Senator Carter has a long history of the kind of concerns that we have dealt with in terms of implementation of mental health services under the Oregon Health Plan. And my concerns essentially are that it has been said that the intent of 3624, and I don't doubt that at all, has been to not change how the mental health benefits are administered. However, I think that with the language reading as it currently reads, we could find ourselves in the unintended consequence of having invited reexamination of how the mental health services should be delivered. I think a further complication of this is the bifurcation of responsibility between the Department of Human Services and the Office of Health Policy and Research. I think that the Office of Health Policy and Research clearly has an important role in terms of writing rules or recommending rules, but I think that there has to be a final part, a point of accountability for the system, and that that point of accountability should be with the Department of Human Services in consultation with the Office of Health Policy and Research. I also think that in the event that if there turned out to be a discussion about mental health services that came out of 3624, I would hope that that would go to the Health Services Commission for review, public comment, and to make sure that it does in fact meet the needs of our consumers and our families. So lastly, I hope I'm wrong. I don't want the debate to occur again. I don't want 3624 to set the stage. And the Oregon Association of Community Mental Health Program Directors Legislative Committee is more than happy to work with authors of the bill to try and find language that might articulate what I think is in fact the intent.
Thank you very much. On point, Ann.
Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned until tomorrow.